If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In the latest episode in our monthly series marking the centenary of the BBC, media historian David Hendy and Matt Elton have reached the 1960s, when the BBC was forced to adapt quickly to keep up with the rapid changes transforming British society.
So, David, is it fair to say that, as we pick up this story at the start of the 1960s, the BBC was poised awkwardly between its past and its future?
Yes, I think that idea of it being poised between past and future really neatly sums up where the BBC is at the start of the 60s. The writer E.M. Forster said something interesting about broadcasting. He was actually talking about the third programme, but I think it stands in a way for the BBC more broadly. He said it has two faces, one that faces the past and one that faces the future. And also, to put it slightly differently, a face that reflects and a face that explores. And I think that really captures where we are with the BBC at the start of the 1960s. Just take the issue of multiculturalism, for instance. We've got the Black and White Minstrels, which started in 1958. Even then, a kind of troubling kind of programme genre with dancers blacked up, you know, drawing on that minstrel tradition. And by 1962, there were people inside the BBC already warning programme makers that this was an offensive programme. You've also just finished recently is Caribbean Voices, which was a long-running radio series broadcast to the West Indies, which featured many, many rising talents, writers and poets from the Caribbean. And you'd had dramas on TV like Man from the Sun in 1956, which offered a sympathetic portrayal of the experience of immigrants from the Caribbean. So in terms of multiculturalism, you've got a kind of a mixed balance sheet there. Think about ITV and competition. So ITV had come along in 1955. By 1960, the BBC has responded to ITV. It's work in progress. ITV offered a kind of a faster-paced, brasher, less formal, less deferential approach to news, for instance. And the BBC was changing. It was featuring its newsreaders on TV in vision, not just their voices. Reporters were being less deferential. The presentation of BBC television was tightening up and becoming slicker in a way. And then, of course, there's the turnover of staff, which is really important. You've got a generation of programme makers who are reaching retirement, leaving the BBC, and you've got a new generation, university-educated young men and women who are less deferential, more questioning, and they're kind of looking at a kind of changing society. They see a kind of society which is changing, more broadly, and those changes are being played out and fought over in broadcasting. So people who want society to become more progressive and more permissive in art and culture and cinema and the portrayal of sex and the use of language and so on are kind of pushing into the BBC and trying to kind of shake up what broadcasting, this kind of traditional domestic medium, can do.
You've mentioned a few factors there: external pressure from young people, internal pressure from young people, commercial pressure. Was there a key factor among those that was particularly important or which the BBC felt particularly sensitive about? Or was this more a case of a confluence of factors all happening at the same time?
I mean, I think it is really a confluence, but age, the sort of, if you like, the generational kind of conflict which seems to be emerging, perhaps underpins a lot of them. So yes, in terms of kind of youth, you've got a kind of a flowering of a teenage culture for which, you know, music is quite central. And although the BBC has, right from the beginning, been broadcasting music, including popular music, dance music, it's clear that in the early 1960s, it's not keeping up with musical taste. Musical taste is accelerating, it's changing. Pop culture means there's always something new every week, every month. And the BBC is just not able to capture that. In terms of competition, yes, you've got other television services, you've got ITV, and the BBC has to respond to that. But actually, when you read accounts of program makers who are in the BBC in the late 50s and the early 60s, one of the phrases that leapt out at me was Hugh Weldon, who said, "We were in competition with ourselves." So to some extent, we have to remember that there is an organic process here that is within the BBC, that not just that turnover of staff, but the same staff who see their job as sensing the changes in society and trying to capture what is happening at any given moment. Two other factors that I think are really important that perhaps we haven't touched on yet. One is there's a new director general. Hugh Carlton Green is Director General in 1960, at the very start of the decade. Now, Hugh Carlton Green has been around in the BBC since the Second World War. He came in as a director of the German service during wartime and was involved rising up the ranks through news and current affairs and external broadcasting through the 1950s. And he becomes Director General. And in many ways, he's as dominating and influential a figure on the BBC in the 1960s as Reith was in the 20s and the early 30s. He's someone who sends out a message to his staff, which is, let's throw open the windows, let's blow away what he called the sort of ivory tower stuffiness, and let's actually, you know, be ahead of public taste, not always behind it. And at the same time, and this is the final crucial factor, I think, the BBC is actually well-resourced at this point. It's got plenty of TV licence fee income coming in. It's got a new television centre which opens. It's sort of feeling confident, and it's feeling as if it's got the resources and the firepower to make good and exciting programmes.
It would be great to talk through some of those programmes, some of the ways in which this wind of change, if you like, actually impacted on particular genres, I suppose. I mean, what were some of the key innovations in terms of satire and in terms of drama, which were two of the big things that experienced change, I think?
Well, you mentioned satire, and I suppose the preeminent example of that would be That Was the Week That Was, which launches in November 1962. It actually only runs for sort of two seasons. So you know, by the end of 1963, it's gone. So it has this sort of brief, extraordinary life that rides the wave of the early 60s satire boom. And what's interesting about it from a BBC point of view is that it's the BBC doing it. You know, old-fashioned auntie, as it were, is part of the satire boom. And it's also that it was a kind of blend of news and satire. It wasn't actually the light entertainment department that made it. It was kind of news and current affairs people. And this mixing of news and entertainment was pretty new territory for the BBC. And the style of the programme as well. It was clearly anti-establishment, not necessarily progressive, but it was anti-establishment. And it seemed to be something that was by young people for young people. A late Saturday night show. David Frost was in his early 20s as the main presenter. You have Bernard Levin offering acerbic interviews and commentary, Millicent Martin singing the theme song. And the studio setup is kind of cluttered and raw and chaotic. So, you know, when you're watching this show, you see the cameras moving around, you see the kind of lighting rig, you see the audience and so on. And it sort of captures this idea that it didn't want to be smooth. It was challenging the whole idea of artifice. So it wasn't just about content. It was the kind of the whole style of That Was the Week That Was that offered something new. You mentioned drama, and I suppose, again, the preeminent example of that would be the Wednesday play, which later turns into Play for Today when it moves from Wednesday. From 1964, you've got the Wednesday play, which draws on a wide range of dramatists and styles, but perhaps becomes most famous for the kind of gritty realism tradition that you can see in other drama series like Zed Cars. That was something that was around and very influential. And the classic Wednesday plays, I suppose, would be Up the Junction in 1965 and Kathy Come Home in 1966, both directed by Ken Loach, who, when he talks about those programs, he makes clear that he was deliberately setting out to kind of intervene on social issues in the case of those two dramas about abortion and about homelessness. So this was politically pointed drama. Now, not every Wednesday play or Play for Today was explicitly political as that. As I say, it kind of offered a range of styles. But I think that captures the kind of the part of the new tone and the new feel. The really important thing to remember is there's always plenty of traditional stuff still around and plenty of kind of, as it were, traditional Reithian uplift. So, you know, at the end of the decade, 1969, you've got Kenneth Clark presenting Civilization, a kind of, in a way, kind of the grand man's vision, a patrician vision of the history of Western art. I mean, a fantastic series, but deeply traditional in many ways. And that even some of those shows that we associate with the kind of the new pop culture, like Jukebox Jury, are actually kind of somehow very BBC. I mean, you know, David Jacobs, the presenter, this avuncular figure and a programme that really was designed very much for the sort of the family audience rather than just the teenager. So, you know, throughout the 60s, in a sense, we've got programmes that are emblematic, not just of the kind of the new style, but of a BBC that's a mix, a jumble of the new and the old.
This is really interesting. This idea of it being a jumble, of the BBC existing somewhere on a continuum between its old traditions and these new forms, new ways of doing things. How hard was it for the BBC and the people that worked there to judge to what extent things could be pushed in these types of programmes? And what sort of initial response were these new innovations met with, I suppose?
I suppose if you peer inside the BBC in the 1960s, and you do that, I guess, looking at the records of things like the Weekly Programme Review Board and all these editorial discussions, what you see is a BBC which is spending an almost infinite amount of time discussing these things and grappling with these things. And of course, there are no obvious answers. So you've got a director general in Hugh Carton Green who says this. He goes around and says to his senior staff, if you don't upset part of your audience most of the time, you're not doing your job properly. Now, that's a real encouragement to take risks, right? But then you've also got this old continuing Reithian idea that, yes, it's okay to lead, to be ahead of public taste, but if you're too far ahead of public taste, you're going to leave the public behind. So there's always a measurement of public taste. And if you look at the minutes of these weekly programme review boards where all the senior programme makers and heads of departments gather every week and chew over the programmes of the week and the issues that arise, they use their professional instincts, but they also look at what the newspapers are saying. They look at the audience research. They look at the letters and the phone calls they've received. And they blend all of these factors in to try and reach a judgment. But it's hard. There was one person at a weekly program review board who said trying to draw the line in terms of public taste was like trying to draw a line in mist. And so, you know, just take the example of language. There were certain words that the BBC knew it either couldn't broadcast because they were too strong, or if they were to be included, let's say in a kind of difficult, controversial drama, then they were referable words. In other words, you had to refer to your line manager and it might eventually go right up to the director general. Well, that's fine for the most extreme words, but what about bloody or damn, and words like that, that are kind of demotic words in common speech? And if you've got dramatists who want to reflect the world as it is, it's going to have to use words like that. Do you refer those? Do you exclude them? If you exclude them, won't the BBC sound a little bit prissy and old-fashioned? If you include too many of them, will it just offend the audience so much that the audience is lost? So there's no straightforward answer to this. And the BBC is aware that while it's got dramatists and writers and young programme makers pushing in one direction, it's also got, outside of the BBC, people like Mary Whitehouse, most famously, who is determined to take a stand and actually say, whatever you, the BBC, think you're doing, there is a silent majority, as she would refer to it, who believe that actually there's too much kitchen sink drama and not enough of the kind of cosy sitting room, if you like. So the BBC is just, I'm not sure if the BBC finds an answer to all this, but it's constantly aware of this issue and trying to kind of navigate some way through it.
Did the launch of BBC Two in 1964 give the BBC new opportunities? And I suppose, how did it view this new channel?
I suppose in many ways, BBC television having a second channel was rather like the creation of the third programme in 1946 and what that did for radio, in terms of creating a space where a few risks could be taken without necessarily undermining the effort of the main channel, what became BBC One, whose job it was really to compete with ITV in terms of kind of the ratings battle, which was pretty ferocious for much of the 1960s. So BBC Two was this blank slate, if you like, that could create space for experimentation, for trying new formats. And he wasn't the first controller of BBC Two, but he was the controller for much of this period. David Attenborough really sort of invented BBC Two very much in his own image as a kind of Renaissance man. In other words, he wanted to kind of widen the range of subjects which could be tackled. Archaeology, had that been done on television? Well, let's have a go. Anthropology, let's do that. Sport, that's a bit tricky because existing channels have rights over certain sporting events and we don't want to undermine them. So what are we left with? Not very much. What about floodlit rugby? What about snooker? What about putting snooker on television? And the range on BBC Two becomes kind of fantastically varied, even more varied than perhaps on Radio 1. You've got, you know, Kenneth Clark's civilization at one extreme and then kind of modern pop shows at the other extreme and snooker in the middle. So BBC Two kind of provides this sort of new playground for invention, if you like, in television, where a few risks can be taken. But what also happens is that, you know, David Attenborough, being a good BBC man, has conversations with his colleagues who are running BBC One, and it's a coordinated effort. So it's all part of one BBC. And, you know, the idea is that there would be a kind of useful contrast between the two at given times, and they coordinated in terms of programme junctions and so on. And, of course, the arrival of BBC Two, in a sense, really helps the BBC in the ratings war. You know, they were equally poised, one BBC television channel and ITV, and now the BBC has two channels and ITV just one. So it really helps, again, boost the BBC, gives it confidence. It's a kind of expanding, confident organisation at this stage.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So the government takes action to close down the pirates, but it realises there has to be some sort of legal alternative. And it's the BBC that is lined up to provide this legal alternative. And it emerges in September 1967 in the form of Radio One.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Is it right to say that the third channel had become available as an idea and then the government decided to give it to the BBC rather than ITV? Is that how that worked?
Yes, there was a government inquiry, the Pilkington Committee, which sat, and a third channel was up for grabs. It was by no means certain whether that would go to the commercial sector or go to the BBC, although there were quite a few people on the Pilkington Committee, like Richard Hoggart, for instance, who were kind of, as it were, more sympathetic to the BBC than to commercial broadcasting. And Hugh Carlton Green actually mobilised an extraordinarily kind of clever effort. I mean, he'd been involved in some sort of, you know, what we might call psyops operation after the war. And he knew how to kind of run a campaign and was very, very clever about kind of steering the Pilkington Committee towards the right conclusion, which was to award this channel to the BBC. So, yeah, the BBC were pretty kind of clever about managing this. So, but the committee, in a sense, was veering that way anyway.
You mentioned Radio 1 there, so we should move to radio. What were the BBC's radio offerings in the first half of the decade? And did they experience these similar sort of social pressures to change as the TV channels did?
One of the great BBC radio figures who joined in the 1930s and actually retired, left at the end of the 60s, was Geoffrey Brideson, who made some wonderful documentaries. And he described BBC radio at the end of the 50s and the early 60s as, quotes, in the doldrums. And, I mean, his reason for saying that was partly that it was still struggling to find an identity and a purpose with the rise of television. I mean, you know, more and more people were watching television, especially in the evening, which had been kind of one of radio's traditional peak times. So radio was having to adjust to being a kind of daytime medium. It was having to adjust to being a bit of a background medium. People didn't really any longer kind of sit down and sort of pay attention to the radio like they did to the television set. Radio was on in the kitchen or sometimes the bedroom, and increasingly later it would be on in the car. So was radio doing the right thing? Were kind of elaborate set piece dramas and features and documentaries the right sort of thing? Or should radio reinvent itself as a so-called secondary background medium? You know, it should be everything should be sort of short and manageable and digestible in short chunks, you know, 3 minutes of this and 3 minutes of that. Should radio stations be more predictable so that people knew what they were getting instead of a kind of rich mix on each channel? Should people know, well, if I tune into that, I'll get music, and if I tune into that, I'll get speech or news and so on? So all these debates were happening, but beneath the surface there was constant change and evolution. Radio was becoming more informal. In the early 60s, you've got, again, new people coming into the domestic radio services, people like Jerry Mansell, for instance, who'd come from the World Service and takes over the home programme and is keen on more informality. less scriptedness. He wanted kind of something that was a bit sparkier and more spontaneous. With portable recordings and magnetic tape becoming kind of cheaper and more available, you've got more actuality, you know, recording spontaneously interviews rather than having to script things in the studio. So all of these changes are taking place. The biggest challenge in a way for BBC Radio in the early 60s was over music and needle time. And the simple reality the BBC came up against was that even if it wanted to broadcast more pop music, it wasn't able to. It was restricted to something like 30 hours total of needle time. In other words, the amount of recorded music on gramophone records it could play in order to kind of honour agreements with the musicians' unions and performing rights society and publishers and so on. Across all channels, across all its radio channels, 30 hours. So it was really difficult. It had a few pop music programmes. You know, Brian Matthews was trying to do his thing on a Saturday morning and so on. But really, there wasn't the capacity to reflect those cultural changes that we talked about, that kind of the kind of youth quake in musical taste.
And then what was the key factor that led the BBC to think, right, we do need to have a pop music station in our offering?
Well, of course, it's the radio pirates. The pirates, you know, they flourish in the mid-1960s. So in Easter 1964 is when Radio Caroline suddenly pops up on a kind of ship sailing around the British coast. And within a short period, you've got several pirate radio stations existing on beyond the reach of kind of legislative authority. So they're not having to pay their dues to musical performers or publishers. They can play as much pop music as they want to. And they have this amazing buccaneering spirit, and they have young presenters who are appealing to young listeners. And millions of people are tuning in because the BBC is not offering anything for them. And they're an extraordinary success, but they are illegal and they are getting the UK authorities into trouble with the kind of in terms of its international obligations about wavelengths and security and payments and so on. So the government takes action to close down the pirates, but it realizes there has to be some sort of legal alternative. And it's the BBC that is lined up to provide this legal alternative. And it emerges in September 1967, in the form of Radio One. Now, Radio One is a BBC pop radio channel. It's a huge innovation, but of course, it's part of a more general shakeup of radio, because up until this point, we've got this pyramid of three services. We've got the light program, the home service, and the third. And overnight, they disappear and they're relaunched as Radio 1, Radio 2, which really is the old light programme, Radio 3, which is the old third programme, and Radio 4, which is the old home service. And cultural commentators, in a way, are agog at this, because the home service was regarded very much as the kind of the bedrock of the Reithian BBC. And yet here it was, number 4. It seemed to be demoted in some way. And Radio 1, the number one position, was this new upstart pop station. And, you know, as one of the commentaries in the press put it, this was or appeared to be Auntie's first freak out. So it was a seminal moment, I think, in terms of radio, in this launch of a dedicated pop station.
Who were some of the key figures and I suppose some of the key programmes in this new Radio One, this new channel?
Well, before we talk about the presenters, I think it's worth just flagging the man behind it all, in a sense, the controller, who was Robin Scott, who, rather like Hugh Carton Green, was a kind of figure who'd been at the BBC for a long time. Robin Scott, the White Tornado, as he was called because of his kind of shock of white hair, was someone who worked in the French service going back to the wartime. So he wasn't a young Turk. he wasn't part of the youthquake, as it were, but he knew that his job was to recruit the kind of presenters who would reflect some of that buccaneering spirit and excitement of the pirates. So it was Robin Scott who set about, if you like, organising some key bits of headhunting as the pirates were shut down. Perhaps the most important figure, first of all, was Tony Blackburn, who was the breakfast show presenter on the new Radio 1. And he'd been at Radio London and was headhunted from that. And, I mean, in many ways, he was typical of the daytime Radio 1 disc jockey. He was kind of breezy. He was chatty. He was a little bit flirtatious as well. There was this notion that the presenters, who were all at this stage men, were sort of husband substitutes for the quotes, the housewife audience. So there was a lot of sort of stereotypical kind of thinking here. But he was a consummate professional in terms of, you know, managing the studio and playing the records and so on. And he loved it. You know, he loved the jingles. He loved the chat. And a perfect figure for the breakfast show in these early days. There was a saying that eventually emerged at Radio 1, which was that it was ratings by day, reputation by night. And so the idea of the daytime show was to be as popular and accessible and as bright and breezy as possible. You don't need to be passionate or particularly interested in the music. You just need to kind of share it with the audience. But at nighttime and at weekends, you've got more specialist presenters who are passionate fans about particular kinds of music. And I suppose the most emblematic figure there is John Peel, who joins again from Radio London, where he'd been briefly presenting a cult programme called Perfumed Garden, which was a kind of eclectic collection of all sorts of kind of music at the margins of rock. And John Peel had this sort of hippie-ish sort of cult style, ready-made off the shelf for Radio 1. He'd kind of developed it at the Perfumed Garden, but he'd also spent a few years in the States doing late-night shifts on local radio stations, buying lots of records, immersing himself in the music scene. So he was incredibly knowledgeable about music. And he saw his job actually in very, very Reithian ways. He might not necessarily have talked about Reith, but he described his task as, you know, making people aware of music that they might not otherwise have heard. It's a classic Reithian ambition. And I suppose a third person who is definitely worth mentioning is Annie Nightingale. Now, she's not there at the beginning. In fact, she tries to join Radio 1. She's an experienced music journalist, exactly the kind of person who you'd imagine Radio 1 would want. But she's, in a sense, a real, very clear victim of the kind of sexism in terms of Radio 1's recruitment policy, this idea that presenters needed to be men because they were husband substitutes. But in 1970, I think the BBC realises that it can't sustain this position. And so she joins Radio 1 and is very much in that same tradition of John Peel, of being a music enthusiast who sort of shares her passion and selects music carefully. She's not just putting on the music that she's been told to play. She's involved in that selection process. And so right from the beginning, you've got a Radio 1 which has this sort of central sort of flavour of kind of, you know, cheesy pop-tastic music, as it were, but also has this sort of interesting activity at the margins, which is much more experimental and radical and exploratory.
Writing at the end of the 50s, some commentators wondered whether broadcasting might help create a common culture in Britain. As we reached the end of the 60s, the start of the 70s, had that come to pass?
I don't think it had. I mean, you know, it was someone like Richard Hoggart, for instance, really hoped and believed that broadcasting had that ability to forge a common culture. But there's another cultural commentator who's important at this stage, Raymond Williams, who famously says culture is ordinary. It's part of everyday life. And the reality was that everyday life showed that tastes in a way were diverging, and that sort of class distinctions were just as embedded as they ever had been, and that new distinctions, especially that one between age range, you know, the generational distinctions were becoming stronger. So I think that the difficulty for the BBC is that actually, you know, culture, as it were, is sort of fragmenting and diversifying. And the BBC's response, in a way, is the only one it could make, which is not to force everything into a kind of middle brow that might be the average of all of these cultures, but to kind of embrace and reflect this fragmentation, this diversity. So, you know, it doesn't go highbrow, it doesn't go lowbrow, it doesn't go middlebrow, it kind of goes widebrow in a way, and widens the range. So, yes, you've got Top of the Pops, and you've got Kenneth Clark's Civilization, and all sorts of things like that that stretch the range. And underpinning that, I suppose, is an acceptance that not everything will be liked by everyone, and that the kind of programmes that need to be made do not need to please everyone. And that's where I think we can see the importance of the key change in the BBC in the 1960s under Hugh Carton Green and through that generational change, which is that progressive ideas, if you like, had percolated through the system. It wasn't a kind of total revolution. You've still got the traditional alongside the news. But you've got this key idea which has taken root that broadcasting, television, radio, doesn't any longer have to kind of think that everything that goes on air has to be suitable for everyone. And that, I think, is a really important distinction between the BBC at the end of the decade and the BBC at the beginning of the decade.
That was David Hendy. You can read more from David in every issue of BBC History magazine. And his book, The BBC, A People's History, is out now, published by Profile. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.